And another week's gone by, which means I'm back. Unlike dear old Trevor there, who's actually, I think he's gone off to Tauranga or somewhere. Suffice it to say, that was last week's Celtic Meets Country. We hope you enjoyed it the second time round, if that was the second time round for you. Now, I'm not going to play anything the second time round this week. I'm going to start with from where I left off, as a matter of fact, which is, well, you know, an excellent place to start. I'm starting with the New York Dolls and Babylon from 1974. Elegantly wasted, the New York Dolls took the Rolling Stones' blueprint, obsessive love of R&B and pop music, plus great style and clothes, and gave it a downtown New York context. The New York Dolls were so far over the top of what was thought to be acceptable of the early 70s that they stood no chance of being understood once they left the island of Manhattan. Of course, history has given them their due as complete originals. As devotees of 60s pop, it was made sense for the Dolls to enlist the Shangri-La's producer Shadow Morton to help with their second album, Too Much Too Soon. "The Dolls had energy, sort of disciplined weirdness," said Morton. "I took them into a room in the challenge. I was bored with the music and the business. The Dolls certainly snap you out of the boredom. We were pushing it. We were running at 26 hours a day. They had an incredible amount of energy. God, I remember the scenes in the studio. The word intense is not intense enough. I do not, if I let them know what they naturally did, and merely try to catch some of it on tape." The Dolls had great ideas. They couldn't play well. They had terrible problems with drugs. In the studio, they dressed up the R&B songs, then pulled them apart with a trashy nonchalance. Babylon opened the album as a tribute to the downtown New York was like at the time. Junkies, strippers, and guys going nowhere fast. It was a long stretch from here to the Ramones or Television or Blondie. The Dolls tottered through the song like a tipsy drag queen negotiating the streets on platform shoes. All dressed up to go out in style. The New York Dolls and Babylon, ladies and gentlemen.
Come on, boys! I gotta get out of here.
That was the New York Dolls and Babylon. You're listening to Waiheke Radio 88.3 and Fano 7.4 FM. And this is 1001 Songs, the greatest songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell, with me, your host, Seth. I don't think I've ever used the phrase "me, your host" before. Quite like it. Suits me, don't you think? Me, your host, Seth. Now, Toby Cresswell, distinguished gentleman of some distinguishment, Australian fella, editor of the Rolling Stone during some time in the 1980s, says in the back of the book, 1987 to 1992. Basically, Mr. Cresswell there, what he was doing when he wrote this book is he's not necessarily trying to say these are the greatest songs of all time. He's more trying to say these. Oh, I explain this every week, and I just can't explain it this week. I'm very, very sorry, and apologise for any inconvenience, but It's got something to do with him not, he's saying the songs that are most influential all over music over the past 100 years. Not necessarily the greatest songs of all time, not the canon, not the be-all and end-all of songs. Just the songs that are reasonably influential on music over the past 100 years. Some of them, he admits, are crap. You have to make up your own mind whether this song is crap. Personally, I think it's alright. It's Cheap Trick, and I Want You to Rock Me. Want You to Want Me. Oh, dear, I am doing awfully tonight, aren't I? It's one of the ironies of pop that Cheap Trick had dumped I Want You to Want Me from their set before their first Japanese tour on April 1978. The group had two unsuccessful albums out in the US, but they were superstars in Japan. They were overwhelmed. They went from playing bars in the US to the Budokan, Japan's major stadium. "The first night, we almost dropped our gear," said drummer Bun E. Carlos. "We didn't know it was coming. It freaked us out." And they were short of material on tour and put I Want You to Want Me back in the set. The group had been working with producer Tom Verman, or Werman, something, who had smoothed some of the rough edges from Cheap Trick's bar band sound. I Want You to Want Me had been written years earlier as an ironic pop song. Not iconic, is iconic now maybe, but it wasn't then. But now the wit went into musical phrases and harmonies and allowed the song to be a magnificent anthem of teen love. At Budokan, originally recorded at a Japan-only release, became a massive hit in the US. It's hard to really know what made you famous. We didn't know why people like the live versions, not the studio versions. We didn't know what to do next. Well, I know what I'm going to do next. I'm going to put that song on for you.
I'm
Cheap Trick and I Want You to Want Me. Somebody once told me that that took them back to Arkell's Bay, 1979. And you are definitely listening to Waiheke Radio here. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, the secrets behind them. I really should say that slower, shouldn't I? And the great songs of all time, the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Australian music journalist Toby Creswell and presented as presented by me, myself, and I, Seth.
Next up, we got the Specials and a message to you, Rudy.
The Specials and Message to You, Rudy. You're listening to Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Creswell and presented by me, Seth Tetley-Jones. I managed to do that quite well, didn't I? Quite surprising. Now, this next track, and I've checked and double-checked that we've got this one. This is Mercury Rev and their Opus 40 from V2 Records. That's, you know, that's Richard Branson's project, if I remember rightly. And it's from their 1998 album, Deserters Songs. Mercury Rev is one of those few groups who can overcome their own hype. The Rev, Jonathan Donahue, Sean Grasshopper Maciawak, came in on the same dispassionate slacker house as Dinosaur Jr. Based in upstate New York, however, they gradually became less slacker, and with that commitment, they became some of the most passionate American music of recent years. Breakthrough was Deserters Songs, the key track Opus 40. Donahue has various as a vaporous singing style that blows around the melody. On Deserters Songs, they steamed up with a couple of locals, drummer Levon Helm and organist Garth Hudson of the band. Not only does their presence put Mercury Rev in a Defet tradition, it also gives the record an earthy grounding. Donahue, in particular, is a great ear for texture and for experiment, but the end result on Opus 40 is the synthesis of avant-garde and roots music. the rusic to and matches the lyric which dives into existential pain. The deserted songs is internalized, Donahue told Mojo's Andy Gill. I think the lyrics are a lot deeper embedded emotionally. The record has a lot to do with feeling deserted and at the same time deserting someone. It's like love. Sometimes you're leaving and sometimes she's leaving, and it's never quite easy to say which. That's his take on it, and he wrote the damn thing, so I suppose you've had the best opinion you can have on it. You know, you've got to form your own, you know.
Well, she tossed all night like a raging sea. Woke up and climbed from the suicide machine. With her Spanish candles and her Persian palms, stuck on the rocks inside Opus 40 stone. And scratching her wrists in the pouring rain, she collapses down upon the ocean floor.
That was Mercury Rev from their Opus 40, and
you're listening to Waiheke Radio.
Why should I have to say it when I have the computer to say it for me just like that, so perfectly? I don't have the computer to say this for me, though. What I have to say is that the next track is Cold Turkey by the Plastic Ono Band, written by John Lennon in 1970. And it appears on Live Peace in Toronto. On a whim, John Lennon agreed to play at a festival in Toronto to aid world peace. Lennon's real motivations are unclear still, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. The Plastic Ono Band was hastily assembled. Eric Clapton on guitar, session drummer Alan White, bass player Klaus Voormann, and John Lennon and Yoko Ono. The rehearsals took place on an aeroplane flight between London and Toronto. It had been 4 years since Lennon had last played to a large audience at Candlestick Park at San Francisco. The ex-Beatle was in a difficult place creatively. He was keen to make music with Yoko, but felt constrained to remain with the Fab Four. His tastes in music were right out on left field, or back in the 50s, on what's... So that's what the Plastic Ono Band did. A series of rock and roll covers and some long improvisations for Yoko's avant-garde workouts. Lennon was ill before going on stage, vomiting with stage fright. Then he came out and tore through a quick set. Cold Turkey is about heroin withdrawal, something that he and Yoko and Clapton were all familiar with. This live version of the song, which had recently been a single, is raw and naked and on the edge, full of fear and pain, and much more intense than the studio version. Clapton tears apart the guitar lines at the top of his game with an aggression that is not usually found in his playing. John Lennon just lets it all out, and Yoko's vocals support and add to the drama. On this song, Lennon achieves what he struggled to do on the last Beatles sessions and his own solo singles: express a modern sensibility with the crude power of 1950s rock and roll. John, Plastic Ono Band and Cold Turkey. Sky, my feet are so heavy. the plastic on her bands. Cold turkey, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4. And this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, or i.e. the most influential songs of the last 100 years. I think that's really, you know, what I'm getting from this book is that he really wanted to put that on the cover, but, you know, the publisher must have said, oh no, it's too tepid, it's too tentative. So, instead, we've got 1001 Songs, the greatest songs of all time. But suffice it to say, despite, regardless of its tepidity and tentativeness, it remains selected by Toby Cresswell and presented by yours truly, Seth. Now, coming up, we've got Elvis and Heartbreak Hotel from 1956. Elvis Presley was still a rockabilly singer in Memphis when he discovered the Heartbreak Hotel. Jacksonville schoolteacher and mother of two, Mae Bruin Axton, had written the song with Tommy Durden, inspired by a suicide victim who'd left a note that read, "I walk a lonely street." Axton was moved to pick up a pen. "I say it to Tommy, everybody in the world, and somebody who cares. Let's put a Heartbreak Hotel at the end of this lonely street." Axton was writing for the teen press that had done some publicity for Presley's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, and through him, he reached the singer. Elvis liked the song enough not only to record it, but to take a third of the publishing credit and income. Heartbreak Hotel was to be his first national number one hit. Elvis recorded a song at RCA's Nashville studio on the 10th of January, 1956, with Scotty Moore on electric guitar, Bill Black on bass, DJ Fontana on drums, and Floyd Kramer on piano. The reverb that dominates the sound of the track was created by putting a speaker at the end of a hallway. I'm not sure if I'm quite entirely sure if I read this right, but I reckon that Elvis did that with the same song. It was, you know, that one he did in 1960, you know, "Are You Lonesome Tonight?" You know, and he has that bit in the middle, and he goes, "I wonder if you're lonesome tonight." It's all a bit disturbingly Jim Reeves for my taste, but there you are. I think he did the same thing there, but that was about 5 years later. It was the second song recorded at the session, only 2 days past Elvis's 21st birthday. Heartbreak Hotel is a kind of ghoulish song. It's not the usual top 40 fare. It was released as a single... keep saying signal for some reason tonight, you know. Don't know why, actually. On the 17th of January, on 1956, and went on to sell 2 million copies. Mae Axton's son became a major country star and writer of many hit records himself, Elvis Presley, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, I keep saying that tonight, too. Let's get out of these catchphrases. Maybe I should do catchphrases, actually. I'm just sort of having a mental debate on air. Okay, Elvis Presley, ladies and gentlemen, Heartbreak Hotel.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be. I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. I'll be just so lonely, baby. I'll be just so lonely. I'll be just so lonely, I could die. So lonely, they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you got a tale to tell. Or just take a walk down Lonely Street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be. Well, you'll be just so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely. You'll be so lonely, you could die.
Thank you. so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely. Well, they're so lonely they could die.
Well, I suppose out of 1001 tracks of the past 100 years or so, I mean, that had to be one of them. Elvis Presley and Heartbreak Hotel. You're listening to Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. And this is 1001 songs, funnily enough. The great songs of all time and the artists, the stories and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Crespel. And I'm Seth Titley-Jones. And, actually, now, this next song also probably had to be in the 1001, but maybe just a little bit more grudgingly so when you hear what it is. It's ABBA and Dancing Queen. Any mega pop group, ABBA was not going to buck a trend. So when disco ruled the American airwaves, ABBA went disco. Dancing Queen was ABBA's only number one record in the US. According to the All Music Guide, Dancing Queen was originally called Boogaloo and was based on George McRae's 1974 single Rock Your Baby. I wouldn't be surprised if that one's in this book as well, but I haven't come across it as of yet, and I've sort of found you the first 200 or so songs so far. You really needed to know that, yeah. But I haven't... it probably is in here somewhere. I'll look into that. Over the course of some months, Dancing Queen evolved with lyrics partly contributed by ABBA manager Stig Anderson. Benny Anderson and Björn Ulvaeus gradually developed the rhythm track, which is a Europop version of American disco, supposedly with a New Orleans influence, care of Dr. John. Essentially, ABBA was replicating the wall of sound. The major difference between ABBA and Spectre is the grandeur of the vision. Where Spectre built a monument to passion and romance, Dancing Queen was more filigree and immediate. Where Spectre created a mansion, ABBA had created a nightclub, which is not to take anything from Dancing Queen. The vocals were layered so that Frida Lyngstad and Agatha Fältskog were entwined in the mystery of the Dancing Queen. The dynamism of the vocal track is enhanced by the fact that vocal is brought in halfway through a chorus. Dancing Queen is the ultimate in Europop. Seductive but not sexy. Like all good pop, it was filled with the promise of Saturday night in your best dress.
Yeah.
if that was ABBA and Dancing Queen. If you don't know what that is, well, you do now. The Velvet Underground and Heroin are next. This was not the first song about hard drugs in the canon of popular music. It was the first song that told it like it was. The innovation of Lou Reed's writing in this song was the dispassion. There are no moral judgments, simply a statement of the experience. After leaving college, Lou Reed worked for a music publisher, Pickwick, turning out anonymous would-be top 40 tunes. It was here that he wrote Heroin. Unsurprisingly, Pickwick thought that there was little commercial potential. The Velvet Underground, though, was ideal for this literary material because they mixed in art circles. The group comprised of a couple of English graduates and a fine music graduate in John Cale. And the song is worked up in organic, warm style that belies the subject matter. The subject matter. My sincere apologies there. The group had also found it difficult to get a recording deal. According to guitarist Dr. Sterling Morrison, Ahmet Ertegun liked it, but said, no more of this, no more of the, you know, drug songs. We don't like drug songs. Then we took it over to Elektra, who said some of the content was unacceptable and the whole sound was unacceptable. This viola, can't Cale play anything else? So then we took it to Tom Wilson, who was still at Columbia. He wanted us to wait and come up and sign with him when he moved to the Verve, because he swore that the Verve could, that at Verve we could do anything we wanted. And he was right. We gave something up, of course, because there was no effective marketing on Verve. We were stuck there with the Mothers of Invention and Richie Havens. Artist Andy Warhol financed the marketing of the album at a reported cost of $2,500. The recording conditions were difficult in that one studio was barely finished and didn't work properly. Tom Wilson, one of the greatest producers of the 60s, signed the group to Verve largely because he was romantically interested in singer Nico, but played very little part in recording of the record. According to drummer Mo Tucker, Heroin is such a good song, but it's a pile of garbage on the record. The guys couldn't have their amps up loud in the studio, and I couldn't hear anything. When they got the part where you just speed up, it became this mountain of drum noise. I couldn't hear shit. So I just stopped, and being a little wacky, they just kept going, and that's the one we took. Frank Zappa delayed the release of Velvet's album to avoid the release of Mothers of Invention. That makes no sense, actually, but, you know, it's what Mr. Cresswell wrote. Frank Zappa delayed the release of Velvet's album to avoid the release of Mother's Invention. I'm not going to try and read it again, because no matter how many times I read it, it's just not going to make any sense. No radio stations would touch this song, according to Morrison. They wouldn't even accept advertising for the album because it was about drugs, sex, and perversion. So what? Heroin changed the way rock and roll songs were written ever after. Well, this is a bit awkward. Here we go. Yep. I think I've managed to get it working.
Kingdom, if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm on. try to nullify my life. 'Cause when the blood begins to flow and it shoots up the dropper's neck, when I'm closing in on death, now you can't help me, not you guys or all you sweet girls with all your sweet talk. You can all go take a walk, and I guess I just don't know, and I guess that I just don't know.
Velvet Underground and Heroin. Well, I don't know, I like it. You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM. Now, this is 1001 Songs. the greatest songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets of behind them, as selected by Toby Creswell. Now, I think we've got time for one more track, don't you? We've got U2 and Sunday Bloody Sunday from 1983, and appears on their album War. On Sunday, the 30th of January, 1972, soldiers from the British Army's 1st Parachute Regiment opened fire on unarmed civilian demonstrators at the Bogside Londonderry in Northern Ireland. Thirteen demonstrators were killed protesting the British policy of internment without trial. Bloody Sunday highlighted the butchery and uselessness of the British occupation of Northern Ireland in the public consciousness. It was a turning point for the struggle for a republic. The first Bloody Sunday was the 21st of November 1920. Republican activist Michael Collins assassinated 14 British intelligence officers known as the Cairo Gang. In response to the British Army descended on a football game at Croke Park, Dublin, slaughtering hundreds of spectators, some as young as 11 years old. In 1983, U2, who were Protestants from Era, put their views on this song. The Edge began writing the lyric while Bono was away on his honeymoon. The initial take on the song was stridently anti-violence. The original first line was, "Don't talk to me about the rights of the IRA." Together, they made the lyrics more general in concentrating the song on the central existential question, "How long must I sing this song? It means so much to me, this song, because I'm not sure I got it right," said Bono, told the late Timothy White. "I might have got it wrong, I'm not sure. I originally wanted it to contrast the day, you know. Sunday, Bloody Sunday, the 13 innocent people were shot dead by a Derry in the British Army with Easter Sunday. I wanted to make this contrast, and I thought that it pointed out the awful irony of the fact that these two warring faiths shared the same belief in one God. And I thought how... Now, it was so absurd, really, this Catholic and Protestant rivalry. And so what I wanted to do in the end was, I'm not sure I did this successfully with words, but I certainly did it with the music. The spirit of the song speaks louder than the flesh of it. You too, ladies and gentlemen. Sunday Bloody Sunday."
This is U2 and Sunday Bloody Sunday. You've been listening to 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Creswell, and presented by me, myself, Seth Tetley-Jones. I will be back next Monday at 8 p.m. for the next selection out of these 1001 songs right here on Waiheke Radio.